Good evening. Good evening. Welcome to the Library of the Jewish Theological Seminary. As we begin, please turn off cell phones. Pacemakers you can keep on. Those you might need. My name is David Kramer. I'm the director of the library, and it is my pleasure to welcome you. We have had the privilege and pleasure of running this book talk series now for a number of years. It began in a very modest way, and at the beginning we restricted ourselves to books by JTS faculty members, but we realized that there's a real need for another venue where serious, important Jewish books could be addressed and where we could discuss Jewish books and Jewish culture. And what better place to do that than here at the Library of JTS? And so that is why we are here, and we are really just thrilled that you've come as well. Thank you for being here. You've seen the advertising material, so you know the name of the book. You know the names and bios of the authors. I'm not going to repeat what you already know. But what I do want to do is say a word of introduction in order to emphasize the importance of a book like this and of this book in particular. Again, our commitment is both local books and important Jewish books. I first heard actually of Rabbi Tocher from a close friend of mine who took his position when he left it in Tokyo, Japan. Michael Shudrich. Michael Shudrich, who has now long since been the chief rabbi of Poland. He's a very dear friend of mine. And through Michael, I've come to appreciate that there are a small number of rabbis, and Rabbi Tocher is one of them, and in his way, I think, actually a leading figure in serving international Jewish communities. On its own, that would be a significant fact. But there's another element here, I think, that's worthy of attention. In order to emphasize this, to explain it, I'd like just to recount to you for a minute an experience that I had this morning. I was teaching a class on the East Side, and I got off the subway at 79th Street with an individual who's in that class, and we decided to walk across Central Park together. And the conversation began with, "So how is your Passover?" since the last time this class met was a month ago before Passover. And she began to ask me about different Passover customs, and that led to a discussion of different customs of different Jewish communities around the world. And I began to help explain some of the differences between the practices of different communities, and actually to look at that as a celebration of the broad and diverse experience of Jews in different parts of the world through the ages. In the course of this discussion, somewhere in the middle of Central Park, she looked at me and she says, "What do you know about Chinese Jews?" Right? And I said, "Well, I know that we've got in the rare book room a Chinese Torah scroll," right, which is mentioned in the book, actually. And I said, "I know a little bit about more recent history, but I confess beyond that, I know very little at all." So when I went back to look at this book in advance of the talk, thinking that I should have paid more attention in covering these chapters before I had this conversation with my friend and student, it became immediately apparent how important a source this is. The diversity of perspectives and stories that you'll find in the book is really quite extraordinary. And if we recall that it is to a significant extent the experience of Jews around the world in our various diasporas that has made Jewish culture so rich, then we will appreciate how important it is to have accounts like the ones that are included in this book. With that, I introduce to you the first of the authors who will be presenting, and we will follow their presentations with questions and discussions.
So nice to see everyone. Before I share with you some very special moments during the writing of this book, I promised David that one of the first things I would explain is how I happened to get involved with writing this book, because I know it's one of the main questions on everyone's mind. So in March 2010, my husband Bill and I took a trip sponsored by the Jewish Museum in New York to India. We had a small group.
I can't hear you.
You can't hear me? Wow. I can do that. I thought you could hear, but is this better?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm yelling at you now, okay? We had a small group. There were about 10 of us. And Rabbi Tokeya was the scholar guide to kind of show us India through Jewish eyes. We met him at JFK just prior to departure, and he told us that the minute we landed, we would be going to a wedding, a Jewish wedding in India. And I said, we don't have appropriate clothes for a wedding, and we have no gift. He said, it doesn't matter, we're going. Well, the wedding was wonderful, as was the whole trip. And before we went to the wedding, the rabbi asked me if I would write a little note to the bride and groom on behalf of the whole group, and I did. So in many ways, that trip to India, or maybe it was just my writing that note, I don't know, changed my life. Everywhere we went, Rabbi Tokeya told wonderful stories, as many of you who know Rabbi Tokeya know he is capable of doing. And when we said goodbye, I said, Rabbi, you should write a book. And he said, my children have been telling me that for decades. Well, since we're both of a certain age, as you can see, I turned to him and I said, then what are you waiting for? A few months later, Bill and I suddenly and unexpectedly lost our beloved son, Keith. Around the same time, Rabbi Tokeya called and asked me if I would write the book with him. Now, I wanted to say no, not only because I was depressed, but also because although I am Jewish, I grew up in a small city outside of Boston. You may have already heard a little Boston accent. I cannot get rid of it. I grew up in a small city outside of Boston with no synagogue and no rabbi. And Rabbi Tokeya is an Orthodox rabbi. And I thought to myself, how can we ever communicate effectively, we coming from such different places? But I, despite my reluctance, I said yes, and Rabbi Tokeya said we would write the book in memory of Keith. It turns out that one of the reasons Rabbi Tokeya told such stories so well is that he had been a stand-up comedian. Yeah. Did any of you know that?
No.
A stand-up comedian who, he says, never brought the house down. So I say he became a rabbi so he could lift his congregations up. Anyway, before I knew, every day he would email me a joke, send me a smile for the day. I mean, I was laughing despite myself. And before I knew what hit me, I was well into this project that took us 4 years to complete and which I grew to dearly love. Despite our vastly different backgrounds, it was a match made in heaven, and the process could not have gone any smoother. We have the unlikeliest but loveliest of friendships. Now I want to share with you three special moments from the writing of the book. One memorable moment took place in Israel a couple of years ago. We were with a wonderful guide. His name is Amikam. By the way, if any of you are looking for a great guide in Israel, just ask me. And one night, instead of dropping us off at the hotel, he parked his van and came in with us, despite my assuring him that we'd be fine. It was already our third night at this hotel, and we were having dinner right across the street from the hotel that night on a gift card friends had given us for our 50th anniversary gift, and we didn't need Amikam to come in. But he insisted, and the reason was he had arranged, I cannot believe this, he had arranged for Emmanuel Wahaftig to be in the lobby of the hotel. Now, who is Emmanuel Wahaftig? He was only a baby when all this happened, but his father, Zurich Wahaftig, who you can find in chapter 15, was responsible for saving the lives of thousands of Jews. During the very brief window when Jews who had fled from Europe had come from Vilna, Lithuania, to Kovno, Lithuania, to Moscow, and then to Kobe, Japan, where they were warmly welcomed by the Japanese, before eventually making it to Shanghai, where they were warmly welcomed by the Chinese, and other places. Now, Emanuel, and I should add also that Zorich Wahafdig was one of the Sugihara survivors. Any of you who read Rabbi Tokay's book, The Fugu Plan, know who Sugihara was, and Wahafdig, interestingly enough, was one of his survivors. And because of Wahafdig's efforts, the only yeshiva to survive the Holocaust intact, really, was the Mir Yeshiva from Poland. Interestingly enough, I think this is lovely, but in 1968, when, I've drawn a blank on, Zorich Wahafdig was Israeli Minister of Religion, he and Sugihara had a reunion in 1968, and I've seen the photograph, and it gives me goosebumps when I look at it. So, I've told you that's the first special moment in the book. The second special moment during the course of writing this book was the chapter 4, Beate Sirota Gordon, who was the only woman in the room when the Americans drafted the Japanese Constitution during the occupation. And she refused to leave that room until rights for women and children were included. She read the chapter and tweaked it a little and signed off on it. And the other thing was Emanuel agreed to read the chapter because even though he was only two when the story of his father was taking place, he remembers so much hearing his mother and father talk about it, and he wanted to see had we captured what he felt and knew. And he signed off on it as well. Anyway, Beate read the chapter, tweaked a little, and signed off on it. Never mentioned she wasn't feeling well. And a few months later, she died. She was, I think, 87. Anyway, her memorial service took place at the Asia Society in New York, and I remember sitting there feeling so grateful that she had read and liked the chapter before she died. And I have to say, until just months, I think, before she passed away, whenever those rights, that's Articles 14 and 24 in the Japanese Constitution, she's slightly responsible also for Article 9, which is the no war clause. That's another story. You have to read the book for that part. It would take me too long. But whenever those articles in the Japanese Constitution, they're fragile, and whenever they were threatened, she would fly to Japan and rally the women and the troops, you know, behind her to keep those articles in place. And when I've been reading in the newspaper starting in December this year that Prime Minister Abe Shinzo wants to change the Constitution, I say to myself, it better not be Articles 14 or 24, or I'm going to fly over to Japan and fight on behalf of Beate. But anyway, and last but not least, a moment, an aha moment for me was thanks to Erwin Berg, I don't know if he's here tonight, Mo Berg's cousin. He's a buddy of yours. Well, he did a really good thing. He's the best. Anyway, Mo Berg, who was a brilliant man, a fearless spy, and a Major League Baseball player who contributed to the Japanese love of American baseball. Anyway, Erwin read the chapter as well and approved it, but raised a question about the birth date we had listed for Mo. Now, we had used the same birth date as every resource ever written about Mo Berg, but I'm here to tell you, when the first researcher makes a mistake, it is perpetuated for so long that it becomes fact. So I said to Erwin, I need proof. If you're telling me we have a wrong birth date, I've got to see something. And he had Mo's birth certificate. And the birth certificate has his exact birth date and a name slightly different from the name everyone thinks. We knew Mo was a nickname, but the name on which Mo came, from which Mo came, is he slightly different from the one on his birth certificate. And that birth certificate is in this book. And we now have the only source with Mo Berg's correct birth date and correct name. And for me, that's very special. I thank Erwin Berg daily, if I could, for that moment and for making us the only place that has it correctly. And I have to admit, but it should not leave this room, that periodically I go on Wikipedia. And I don't change what's there, which is wrong, but I say, according to his birth certificate, it appears that he was born blah, 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 and his name was blah, 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 and someone goes in after me and deletes it. Yes, yes, I'm only one person to fight this battle. Anyway, the overwhelming response to all these stories, as Jeffrey Lyons, who was kind enough to write a blurb on the back cover for us, said, who knew? Some of the stories will move you, some will actually make you cry, and some will amuse you and even make you laugh. Laugh out loud. Very few people know, for example, the poignant story we tell in Chapter 11. I was talking with someone here tonight, actually, about it. The story we tell in Chapter 11 of the Comedy of Errors that occurred in Kaifeng, China in the 17th century, when an ethnic Chinese Jew mistook a Jesuit missionary as the rabbi he had been waiting for. Yeah, asked him, when he found out that he wasn't the rabbi, he asked him, would he be their rabbi? Yeah. He was desperately looking for a rabbi. I understand that. I grew up with no rabbis. And one of the stories that I cried when I finished was Chapter 17, which we have called The Betrayal of Wolf Ladejinsky, who was responsible for life-changing land reform in Asia, China, and Japan specifically, but received a cruel and unjust anti-Semitic attack from Secretary of Agriculture Ezra Taft Benson, which embarrassed the Eisenhower administration, but more important to me, devastated Ladejinsky. I don't think he ever recovered from that smack in the face, if you will, undeservedly. But you will smile and even laugh out loud when you read the story of Emily Hahn in Chapter 12. Now there's a colorful character for you. While she smoked cigars and never went anywhere without her pet gibbon, that's a little ape, on her shoulder wearing diapers, and while she walked across Africa alone, lived with a pygmy tribe, and was concubine to a famous Chinese poet, and so much more I could tell you about Emily Hahn, but you need to read about her in the book. She also lived in China. Let's not underestimate how brilliant she was. For all her eccentricities, she lived in China and wrote for the New Yorker magazine for 68 years and wrote more than 50 books introducing China to the West. I could go on and on, but when the book reached more than 300 pages, we stopped. But we have started volume 2, and the stories are equally as wonderful. I'm amazed by some of them as Rabbi Tokeya shares them with me. And it will be the same length as Volume 1, and yet even then, we still won't have told all these wonderful little-known stories. And we're also in the process of raising funds for a three-part documentary series for PBS. There was no anti-Semitism in China or Japan. These countries were blessed with pluralism and multiculturalism, and Buddhism, Hinduism, Shintoism, Taoism, Confucianism are not monotheistic religions, and followers do not believe they have a monopoly on the truth, and therefore they are tolerant of all religions. But what all of the stories in Pepper, Silk, and Ivory, amazing stories about Jews in the Far East, remind us is that people of different races, religions, and cultures can both contribute to and benefit from each other, and in the process, leave the world a better place than they found it. And I think that's a pretty important and relevant message and reminder for today's very troubled world.
Tough act to follow. Can you hear me okay? There's a missing page in the Jewish experience. There's a missing page in Jewish history. Take any history book. This library has a lot of history books. It's a historical movement. Take any Jewish history book you want, skip the book and flip to the back to the index. Look up China, look up Tibet, look up India, look up Japan, look up Siberia, look up Manchuria. What do you find? Nothing. It's as if we've never been there. There's a missing page in Jewish history, which we would like to correct. I would also say that we're blinded by the West. Our ancestry is generally, it's from Poland, it's from Lithuania, it's from Germany, from Baghdad, wherever. And so we always look west, look west, look west. But what our children and grandchildren know very well is that there's no future in Czechoslovakia. There's no future in Norway. The future is in China. The future is in India. The future is in Vietnam. They're getting their religion together, their work ethic together, working very hard, becoming very disciplined. The future is in their hands. And what we do not know is that we have lived in that part of the world for more than 2,000 years. More than 2,000 years. Without ever a day or a second of anti-Semitism, hostility, anger, or bitterness. When our daughter religions came, Islam or Christianity, we could suffer and suffer well. But from Eastern religions, we are the sugar in the tea. We don't attack the tea. We don't destroy the tea. We enhance the tea. And every place that we have lived in the Orient, we have bettered the society. And we live with respect, honor, and dignity. And it's interesting to look at the Eastern world and the Jewish experience in the Eastern world. Let me share with you a story or two. In 1992, China established diplomatic relations with Israel. Long overdue. Wanted on both sides. How do you establish diplomatic relations? An ambassador comes. What does he do? Goes to the foreign minister. Goes to the East Asian desk, or whatever desk deals with his country. Presents a letter of introduction, like a corporate seal, to establish cultural, diplomatic, economic ties between the two countries. Every ambassador does that. Standard operating procedures takes a minute and a half and you're gone. But every ambassador goes through that. The Chinese ambassador in 1992 broke protocol. He opened his mouth and he started to talk. That was surprising. What did he say? He said, I have orders from my country that upon my arrival in Israel, that I show my respect to Jacob Rosenfeld. And I would appreciate your guiding me as to how I could properly show my respect to Jacob Rosenfeld. The foreign minister said, thank you very much. We'll get back to you within a day or so. You'll be able to follow the instructions of your government. It's the end of the meeting. And then everybody goes to the window to see and make sure that the Chinese ambassador's car leaves the parking lot. And now the East Asian desk of the Israeli foreign ministry, the Mishrad HaChutz, and the foreign minister sit around the table to say, interesting, China established diplomatic relations, Mazel Tov, they drank a L'chaim, long overdue, fine. He wants to show his respect to Jacob Rosenfeld, fine. Anyone here know who Jacob Rosenfeld is? They go around the table, no one ever heard of him. Well, what are you going to tell the Chinese ambassador? You see, who knows Jacob Rosenfeld? Who deals with China? No one ever heard of him. Jacob? One Israeli diplomat says, I live in Tel Aviv, the butcher on my street, his name is Jacob Rosenfeld. Why would he, the ambassador wants to see him, I don't know. He said, check the telephone book. 50,000 Jacob Rosenfelds in Israel. What are you going to do now? There's an organization in Israel called Igud Yotzei Sin, Society of Former Residents of China. They're Jews who lived in China. They're not Chinese, but they're Jews who lived in China. There were 50,000 Jews, actually, who lived in China, found refuge in China. And so this organization is in Tel Aviv on Grusenberg Street, Teddy Kaufman, its leader, talented fellow. They call him. Chinese ambassador came, established diplomatic relations, Mazel Tov. He wants to show his respect to Jacob Rosenfeld. He says, who? He says, Jacob Rosenfeld. He says, who's he? He says, I thought you're from China. He says, my first 42 years I lived in China. I was born in China. He says, what about Jacob Rosenfeld? He said, he's not on our list. He says, what are we going to tell the Chinese ambassador? He says, I'll call Tokayer, that's me. He probably heard of him. He calls me in the middle of the night, 7-hour time difference. Tells me this cock and bull story. I said, what did you tell the foreign minister? He said, I just told you. I said, no jokes. What did you tell the foreign ministry? He said, I just told you. I said, what did the foreign ministry said? They said, no one ever heard of him. I said, what's the joke? They said, it's no joke. It's a scandal now. I said, let me tell you who Jacob Rosenfeld is. The government of China issued a postage stamp for Jacob Rosenfeld. That's interesting. In China, there's a statue of Jacob Rosenfeld. Interesting. There's a hospital name for Jacob Rosenfeld. Interesting. Within 10 years, they will build a new city. They build new cities all the time. The name of the city in China is going to be Jacob Rosenfeld. Can you imagine a city in China called Jacob Rosenfeld? Who's Jacob Rosenfeld? Jacob Rosenfeld lived in Austria, lived in Vienna, a liberal, progressive, intellectual, poet, medical doctor. Hitler comes into Vienna. He's now in Dachau concentration camp. They beat the hell out of him. Beat the hell out of him. He had to lift rocks that weighed 300 and 500 pounds. Gave him a heart attack. He's in his 20s. And finally, he's discharged. And he's told, you have 10 days to get out of the country. And if you don't get out, you go back to Dachau, you will not survive. Where's he going to go? America said no. England said no. Canada said no. Australia said no. New Zealand said no. He had no place to go. He has 10 days to get out of the country or he's dead. Where does he go? He goes to China. China was the only place where a Jew could go without a passport or without a visa. Even a false passport and a false visa didn't make any difference. You didn't need any documents. No one asked anything. Just welcome to China. He goes to Shanghai in China. And he becomes Jewish refugee doctor from Germany and Austria, number 26. And he puts up a shingle, which I have a photograph of, Dr. Yaakov Rosenfeld, urology. And he looks at China. He looks at Shanghai. Life expectancy, 42. Interesting. Drinking water, toilet water, the same. Interesting. You have garbage, just throw it out the window. No one's collecting it anyway. You want a good job? I have a good job for you. You walk the streets of Shanghai or China, pick up those who starve to death overnight. Steady work, good pay. And there's a civil war going on in China between Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong, which you may remember. In addition, in 1937, Japan invades China. So you have a foreign fascist invasion, you have a civil war, and you have an absolute a life expectancy, 42. What's going on over there? Yaakov Rosenfeld looks at this and says, we have enough Jewish doctors here. I suffered with the fascists, with the Nazis, and now they're suffering here in China. I want to identify with China. He goes to the Chinese and says, I want to help you. They say, we need all the help we can get. What do you do? I'm a doctor. We don't have any doctors. He says, I'll be your doctor. He says, it's going to be hard work. He says, when you go to Dachau, you don't talk about hard work. He joins the Chinese army. And he marches with the Chinese army. And in every village, separates toilet water and drinking water. Wash your hands with soap. How to make basic pharmaceutical medicines. There was no pharmacy. Out of flowers, barks, leaves, grass, which you could do. How to make medical instruments. There were no medical instruments. And he put the health at the top of the agenda of every town, village, and city that they passed through. He worked 25 hours a day, 8 days a week. If he would have run for prime minister, he would have been elected. They loved him with a passion. He becomes chief of medicine. That's interesting. He becomes a general in the Chinese army. That's interesting. That's Yaakov Rosenfeld. On October 1, 1949, when Mao Zedong in Tiananmen Square announces the People's Republic of China, the end of the revolution, etc., sitting behind him in Tiananmen Square is about three or four rows, not even a back to the seats, of the machers, the important people of the new Chinese government. Sitting among them, on the left side at the end of the row, is Dr. General Yaakov Rosenfeld. His assistant, whom he trained, becomes the first Minister of Health in the first Chinese government. The war is over. The revolution is over. He said, I'm from Vienna. Where's my family? He goes back to Vienna because he hadn't heard from anyone. There was nobody there. He talks to the Jüdische Gemeinde, the Jewish community, keep good records. They say, you have a brother who went to Palestine, that's now Israel. He goes to see his brother. And when he sees his brother, visits with his brother, he volunteers as a doctor in an Israeli hospital. Has a heart attack and dies. Buried in Kiryat Shaul Cemetery in northern Tel Aviv. To this day, to today, every Chinese who visits Israel with the government, diplomats, exchange students, trade mission, everybody except the tourist, anybody who has any connection with the government, who visits Israel, within 1 week you get one of these. You get a guide, you get some flowers, you go to the cemetery and pay your respect to one of the heroes of the People's Republic of China, Yaakov Rosenfeld. How come we never heard of him? How come he's not in our lexicon? How come he's off our radar? Because he's in the Eastern world. The Chinese know him. They issued a postage stamp for him. There's a statue for him. There's a hospital for him. There'll be a city for him. How come we never heard of him? Because we don't know the Jewish experience in the Eastern world. A few years ago, I was in India, and I was in New Delhi at the Taj Mahal Hotel, and I sent an email to what you would call the CEO of maybe Random House, Simon & Schuster, a major publishing house, maybe the largest publishing house in India. I never met him, but I knew who he was. He did not know me either, but he heard of my name. I said, I'm in the Taj Mahal Hotel. I'd like to invite you tomorrow for tea at 2 o'clock. He says, okay, I'll see you tomorrow. We're sitting in the lobby of the hotel. And I'm sitting with a stack of papers like this. He says, what's on your mind? I said, I'm sitting on information that you know, but you don't know. And my people don't know it at all. And it's important for you, it's important for me. He says, what are you talking about? I said, I'll give you an example. I said, what do you think of the Sikhs? Oh, they have the turban, they don't cut their hair, big husky guys. They were fighting in their turf between the Hindus and the Muslims in Punjab in northern India. They're the best fighters in the army. I like the Sikhs. They're very, very generous. They feed tens of thousands of poor people every single day, every day of the week, for free. I say, I'm glad that you like the Sikhs. I said, who was the greatest Sikh general since you said that they're good fighters? He says, the greatest Sikh general? He says, oh, you mean that fellow from Europe? I said, I told you you know it. I said, what was his name? What was his name? You know, we're talking about 1800. Ventura. I said, yeah, it's pretty close. Ventura. Yes, General Ventura. I said, do you know how General Ventura got here to India? He said, I don't know. I said, the time for the Sikh army to reorganize, restructure, need new generals, new strategy, new military equipment. Time to move forward. Time to get a new general commander-in-chief. Then they go to Europe. And they shop for a new general. And everybody in Europe says, go to Italy. There's a young chap there, brilliant, intellectual, poet. Best of all strategies, a rising star. Interview him. They go to Italy and they meet General Ventura, fall in love with him. Invite him to India, he comes to India. And he becomes the commander-in-chief of the Sikh army in the mid-1800s. Okay. So I say to this Indian fellow sitting across from me, I say, do you know the name of General Ventura when he was born? I say, when he was born, his family name was not Ventura. He said, what was his name? I said, his family name was Ben-Tora. Wow. He said, his name is Ben-Tora? I said, you mean General Ventura is Jewish? I said, not only is he Jewish, but his mother is Jewish, his father is Jewish, his sister is Jewish, and his brother is Jewish. His family to this very day still have the name of Ventura and have the name of Ventura. Still live in Italy. He said, how do you know that? I said, I have his birth certificate. He says, you have his birth? Yes, I said, it's going to go to the Sikh Museum. That they should always remember that their great general was born of a Jewish family. He says, wow, I don't believe that. He said, what else you got? I said, you know, what do you think of the gurus? He said, oh, he says, the gurus are India. Meditation and yoga and singing and dance and spirituality. Only India has the guru. Each one is so different, so special, as their own. Gives me a whole song and dance about how he loves the gurus. I said, fine. I said, in your mind, who was the greatest of all the gurus? He says, oh, the mother of all gurus. I said, I appreciate that you have respect for the mother. I said, did you ever meet and visit the mother? He said, yes. I said, you went to the south to Pondicherry? He said, yes. I said, what did you think of the mother? Oh, divine, divine. Actually, a female. He says, she brought out the divine in everyone. The room changed. People changed. They were never the same. It was beyond words. Maybe Heschel would say ineffable. It was a magnificent experience. He said, well, I appreciate the respect that you have for the mother and that you went to visit the mother and so influenced by the mother. I said, did you know that when Indira Gandhi was the prime minister, she never made a move without consulting the mother? He said, I heard that. I said, did you know that everybody goes to see the Dalai Lama in northern India, including myself? I said, but the Dalai Lama went to see the mother. He said, I was not aware of that. I said, do you know the name of the mother when she was born? I don't know. I said, her name was Alfasi. He said, so? I said, what you don't know is that Alfasi is the most prestigious Sephardic Jewish name. A direct descendant from the father, father to father, to Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, one of the giants among the Talmudic scholars. He says, you're telling me that the mother is Jewish? I said, so is her mother and her father and her sister and her brother. I said, her first revelation was in a synagogue, the Rothschild Synagogue in Paris, when there was a divine light that came through the window. And she studied Jewish mysticism, Zohar, Kabbalah, with the son of an Orthodox rabbi from Poland, studied with him in North Africa. And what she was teaching really was really Zohar and Kabbalah, that Jewish aspect of our tradition that we generally ignore. He says, I don't believe this. He said, you know what? I want to take all your papers. I said, don't you dare mess them up. He said, we meet tomorrow at 2 o'clock. I'll buy the tea. I want to read this. Comes back tomorrow at 2 o'clock, bleary-eyed. He said, Tokayer, I didn't sleep all night. He said, I could not believe what you have here, how you can document. You have the document, you have the photograph, you have the interview, you have the article. He said, if you publish this, he said, I'll publish it for you, you'll be making a great mistake. He said, you'll have 8,000 pages and 14,000 names. It'll be a telephone book, they'll throw it in the garbage. Don't do it. You have 8 different subjects here. It's 8 volumes. You want me to do the 8 volumes? I'll do it. You want to shop it? Go shop it. He says, but stick to one subject at a time. And there will be indeed 8 volumes. Volume 1 is published. Volume 2 is published. Volume 3 hopefully will be out this month. How come we don't know that? How come this is not part of our lexicon? How come we don't know? How come the library doesn't know that the oldest Hebrew document on paper, first of all, it's Hebrew. Second of all, it's paper. Who invented paper? Chinese. It's not a scroll, it's not parchment. The oldest Hebrew piece of paper found anywhere in the world. You know where it was found? Dandan Ulik. Can anybody here spell it? Anyone here know where it is? It's on the Chinese-Tibetan border. Do you think somebody wrote it at JTS or went to Tibet and dropped it in the ground? It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. When I returned to America, I went to the New York Public Library because there's one academic article about that piece of paper. And it's in an obscure British journal. And I read the article. It's a good article. I asked the librarian, when's the last time someone asked to read this article? The librarian said, 1936. That's crazy. It's 80 years ago. Where's that piece of paper? It's in London. It's in the British Library. I was going to London, not immediately, but I was going to London. So I wrote a letter to the librarian that I'd be coming to London. I would be so honored to see and to read the oldest Hebrew document on paper that you have in your collection. Librarian writes to me and said, please ring me up. It's a female. Please ring me up when you get to London. I get to London, went there with my wife, go to the library, ring up the librarian. I'm sitting down in the librarian's office. We're sitting down in the presence of the director of the JTS library. And the librarian says to me, Rabbi, if we would have the oldest Hebrew document on paper found anywhere in the world, don't you think I would know about it? I said, what are you talking about? She says, we don't have such a thing. I said, what are you talking about? She says, how do you know that? I said, it's a footnote. Where's the footnote? I said, I didn't bring my library with me. I said, you have it in your library. She says, where is it? I said, how the hell should I know where it is in your library? It's your library. She says, I've cleared the day. We're going to go through the library and see whether we really have it. So they go to the main library, side library, go to the Judaica library, Hebraic library. You have the oldest Hebrew document on paper. No one knew what I was talking about. Finally, after about 3-4 hours, she said, you know, we have a small catalog, maybe 7-8 pages, of Judeo-Persian articles. It's Hebrew, but mostly Farsi language, but written in Hebrew alphabet. Open up the catalog, and there it is. There it is. She was shocked. Took it out. I could read it. The ink was so dark and black, you would think somebody wrote it with black shoe polish yesterday. Paper had turned brown, but the ink was so clear and easy to read. if you could understand it, because I don't understand Farsi. But she said, we're going to put this on exhibit. Please write the index card for it, which I did. How come the librarian didn't know that the oldest Hebrew document on paper found anywhere in the world was in the British Library, and the librarian didn't even know about it? If it would have been found in Kovno in Lithuania, we would know about it. If it would have been in Dusseldorf, we would know about it. In Frankfurt, we would know about it. In Warsaw, we would know about it. But if it's in the Eastern world, it gets lost. And so, since my time is out, has run out, what I wish to keep with you, or hope with for you, is that whether in ancient times, medieval times, modern times, the present time, and even during the Holocaust, when you would least expect it, the time has come to think in terms of a Jewish presence, a Jewish community, and a Jewish history in the Far East. Thank you very much.
So we've got time for questions or comments. Do you want to take these, or would you like me to take the questions? And
you're going to take the questions because they'll be shooting at me.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Rabbi, can you say anything about the current situation of the Jews in Kaifeng?
So the question was about the current situation of Jews in Kaifeng.
There's a lot of changes.
Kaifeng was the capital of China in the Northern Song Dynasty. Today it doesn't have an airport or a train station. It's the boondocks, unfortunately. It's not even the capital of the state. Tsingtao was the capital of the state. Nevertheless, over 1,000 years ago, Jews came there. Jews came there in the Silk Road from Persia. Met with the emperor, said, live near the palace, which they did. Keep your way of life, which they did. Transmit it for the generations, which they did. Ask only for one favor. He says, we can't pronounce your Jewish names. Take Chinese names. And he gave them 7 different Chinese family names, which they keep and they identify themselves to this very day. China closes. They get cut off, intermarry, assimilate. They become Chinese Jews. And played major roles in the growth and development of China, and also disappear. You have a Torah in this building, in the rare book room. They had 13 Torah scrolls. We found 8 of them. Interesting. Worth coming here to see. Even better go to SMU, Southern Methodist here in Dallas, which is the best quality of the Torah scrolls written in the 1300s. You can read every line as if it was written yesterday. And now they're in a process of having a renaissance. The synagogue went down in about 1862. Suffered through a lot of floods. People became very poor, moved away. No one knew anything Jewishly anymore. Although the synagogue could go down, as your house could go down, nobody changes street names. The names remain the same. The name of the street of the synagogue today is Teaching Torah Lane South. That's the name in Chinese. And there's one family there today, still living on that street. Chinese Jews have been living at the same address for 800 years, never moved. This year they had 2 Passover Seders. One led by a Chinese Jew who went to Israel, went through conversion in Israel, wants to be a rabbi, wants to come back to Kaifeng. We'll see how that plays out. One Seder was led by a Chinese fellow from Taiwan, speaks Chinese, speaks English, has free reign in China, because China considers Taiwan to be part of China. And he's a convert and a very knowledgeable fellow, and he conducted another Seder. And there's a process now of having a renaissance as a Jewish school, and they will sing the Hatikvah, the Jewish national anthem, or the Israel national anthem. They will sing it in Hebrew and Chinese. Not a dry eye in the place. Not a dry eye in the place. And so it's certainly worth visiting. And one Chinese Jew who studied at Bar-Ilan University, which I arranged, is a national guide, speaks a perfect English.
Shulei,
he was here actually to see the Chinese Torah, which he saw. I was with him. And then he asked one of the librarians, do you have anything else from Kaifeng? They said, we think we have a prayer book for Sukkot. He says, can I see it? So they found it, brought it to him. He opens it up. He says, that's my grandfather's signature here. Was his grandfather's sitter. Anyway, it's an interesting community to see, because there will be a renaissance. There is a renaissance in Jewish life going on right now as we speak.
Are there just curious, are there active minyanim now in China?
There are 10 Chabad rabbis in China. They are not Chinese. But it's interesting that they have 10. They're not allowed to speak to the Chinese, incidentally. They're not allowed to speak to the Chinese. And there's a sign when you come in there, it said foreign passports only. Because if you speak to Chinese, you're a missionary. Missionaries go to jail. The Roman Catholic bishop is in jail and he will die there. The Chinese Catholic bishop is walking the streets. But you cannot have allegiance to Rome. That's a different country. And missionaries, they suffered with the missionaries. And they suffered with the opium, with the foreign imperialism. And they don't want to hear about missionaries. Because missionaries robbed them of their culture, told them they have a second-class civilization, Christianity is a better civilization. So missionaries are against the law. And if a Chabad rabbi talks to a Chinese, they tell him on the first day there, we catch you talking to a Chinese, you just might as well go to the airport before we tell you to go there. And they keep that. So if a Chinese is interested in Judaism, they send him to Hong Kong. In Hong Kong, it's kosher. So far. But in China, they have no connection with them.
Where do you have Chabad houses in China?
Pardon?
Where are the Chabad houses in China? You know?
Wherever the tourists and business people go.
Shanghai. Check the website, I'm sure. Yes, sir.
I know nothing.
I make it all up, incidentally.
Might as well. I would know no difference.
That's why we wrote the book.
Could you talk about at what point or what the origins of Jewish presence is in China and what the population centers were and how they...
I have difficulty hearing. If you would stand, it would be easier for me.
Okay, he wants to know...
Could you talk about how Jews came to China, or when and how, the manner in which they did so, and then
what the
where
population
there were... large pockets of Jewish populations.
There are waves of Jews. Do you all hear the question?
Yes.
How come you all hear it? I didn't hear it. Maybe I heard a different question. There are waves of immigration into China, or waves of migrations into China. Persian Jews came there on the Silk Road over 1,000 years ago. It was a long, long trek over land, going through the Khyber Pass, over mountains, through deserts. How they made it, I don't know. But they suffered with persecution. I can't say hundreds of went, but maybe 50, 80, something like that. Went to China, went to the capital, settled there, and most of them are still there today. Their numbers could have amounted to 5,000, 10,000 in time. We know of different cities that had Chinese Jews or Jews in China. How do we know that? Because in Kaifeng, where they started, they had a flood. And the synagogue flooded. And they lost their Purim Megillah. And so they write, we contacted Ningbo, and they sent us a spare Purim Megillah. What did that tell me? That there was a synagogue in Ningbo. And there was a synagogue in Xi'an. And there was a synagogue in Hankou. And Marco Polo met Chinese Jews in Beijing in 1242. So that's one migration. How do we know that they're really Persians? At Hebrew Union College, we have their Passover Haggadah. Now, Passover ceremony, which Dr. Kramer was talking about, all different types of ceremonies. Well, I would assume that you at your home, you have a Passover Seder, and you have a Passover, probably have a blue Passover Haggadah from Maxwell House Coffee, or something like that. And it's probably Hebrew on one side and English on the other side. So I assume you're speaking English. What will be Hebrew on one side and French on the other side? I assume you're not having it in Brooklyn, that you're having it somewhere where they speak French. In their Passover Haggadah, where they give directions, stand up, sit down, right side, left side, it's in Farsi. It's in Farsi. And the Chinese Jews today, the seniors, could still speak about 50 to 75 words of Farsi. That's from an ancestor that came 1,000 years ago. That is amazing how still a little bit of Farsi remains with them. In addition, Baghdadi Jews, like Sassoons, Harduns, Kaduris, we have a chapter just on the Sephardim, went from Baghdad to Basra to Bombay. They were giants in Bombay. The port of Bombay today is called the Sassoon Docks. They had cotton mills. which was very successful during the American Civil War, when no cotton was coming out of America. South Carolina, Georgia, there was a blockade from the North. And so India provided the world with cotton. They had 15,000 laborers in their cotton mills in Bombay. That's big business. They also were in the opium business. Anyway, Sassoon has a lot of children, and he sends one to Saigon, one to Yokohama, one to Nagasaki, one to Hong Kong, one to Shanghai. And they start. He says Rothschild. People call them the Rothschilds of the East. They could buy Rothschild out with pocket change. They were bigger than Rothschild. Anyway, in Shanghai, they built a magnificent structured Jewish community. And they were the first, and the Baghdadis were very successful in opium, in real estate, in commodities, in rubber, etc. So then you have Sephardic Jews, namely Baghdadi Jews, coming to China. Their number probably will run about 5,000 to 7,000. Very wealthy and successful for the most part. The largest real estate owner was Silas Hardoon. And the most famous of them and most successful of them was Sir Victor Sassoon, who was the last of the great Sassoons. And Sir Victor Sassoon, his great quotation is, there's only one race greater than the Jewish race, and that's a horse race. And he went to the track every day, and he had a lot of winners. He loved the track. In addition, Russian Jews from Siberia. Siberia borders northern China. And more than 20,000 Russian Jews before the revolution crossed the border into China. The finest Jewish community we probably ever produced in the diaspora was not in Manhattan, but probably in Harbin in northern China, Manchuria. They're all Russian Jews. They lived under the Tsar, lived under the communists, lived under the warlords, lived under the Japanese, lived under Mao Zedong, lived under the Soviets. They did it very, very successfully. So you have Russian Jews, another wave of migration into China. In the Nazi period, the Holocaust time, more than 20,000 refugees from Germany, Austria, and Poland end up in Shanghai. So you have refugees, Russian Jews, Sephardic Jews, Baghdadi Jews, and then you have Chinese Jews. That basically is the population. As I said, totally in China, let's say in 1945, you could probably have about 50,000 Jews living there.
Wow. Yes, ma'am.
I understand that they went from Europe.
Better talk louder.
I understand that they left Europe during the Second World War and went to Japan. Why did they leave Japan to go to China?
Question is, the refugees that got a visa to go to Japan, why did they leave to go to China? They had a transit 10-day visa to Japan. And they were going to Curacao, which was fake. No one ever got to Curacao. No one ever knew. No one ever heard of Curacao in 1940. So they had a transit visa just passing through to go to Curacao. But Curacao was a fake visa. It was only a way they could get out of Europe and escape the fires of Europe. When they arrived in Japan, the next day, you go to the American consulate to get a visa to America. The Americans were very polite, very kind, welcoming, and hospitable. They said the form was printed in Washington, D.C., application to migrate to America. They added one question. Do you have any relatives in Europe? What Jew had no relatives in Europe? Everybody has family in Europe. If you answered that you had even only one relative in Europe, they filed your application in the garbage can. Nobody got to America. So, 10 days came, your visa expired. You should be deported. 20 days passed, 30 days passed, 50 days passed, 90 days, you're on a 10-day visa. You think the Japanese don't know where you are? You think you look just like the Japanese, and they know exactly where you are, they know exactly what you're doing. Nobody was sent back. Plenty of room in Siberia. If your visa expires, they send you back where you came from. They came from Vladivostok in Siberia. So, as Japan was getting ready for Pearl Harbor, did they need a whole yeshiva in Japan on welfare? and they're white and potential spies. They're getting ready for a war. What do they need all these refugees there for? And so they would deported them to Shanghai and said, let Sir Victor Sassoon take care of you. Let the Russian Jews take care of you. Why should we take care of you? So you said you're going to leave here in 10 days, all right? You're here almost a year. Enough is enough. And so they, in the summer of 1941, that's July and August, the war is in December, with Pearl Harbor is in December. But by the end of the summer, basically they were in Shanghai. If they had no place to go to, they would go to Shanghai.
One last question, yeah. Yeah.
You know, I've read your other book, The Frugal Affair, and also you said that you were a rabbi in Japan. Can you talk something about your experience in Japan?
So the question is about his experience as a rabbi in Japan.
Well, I was the chief rabbi of Japan. I was a chief with no Indians.
I'm sorry.
I was the only English-speaking, university-trained rabbi from India to Japan. India was my congregation. Burma was my congregation. Singapore was my congregation. China, Hong Kong was my congregation. We went there for 2 years on a leave of absence. But it was so interesting and so fascinating. I was the only Jewish name that anybody could call from anywhere. If anyone in China, there's a billion people in China, now 1,350,000,000. If anyone was interested in God, Torah, Judaism, anti-Semitism, Israel, Bible, whatever, I was the only number to call. And it was a very interesting, fascinating experience. Our children were made in Japan for export. I said I would not send my children to a Japanese school, and we did send them to a Japanese school. I also said I would not leave until I found a replacement. And to my great astonishment, when I announced everywhere, right, left, and center, that I was leaving, it's a fascinating community, who wants to come here? Nobody wanted to come. And I left really with no replacement because it was time for us to leave, and we said we were leaving. But it was a magnificent experience where I learned a great deal about myself as a human being, as an American, and as a Jew. It really was a mind-boggling experience. We saw a lot and learned a lot, and you could ask my wife, but she learned it from her perspective as well. And she speaks Japanese very, very well and raised her children in Japan, etc. But it was a very, very unusual and interesting experience.
Thank you. So now is the opportunity to buy copies of the book. How much is the book?
$400.
And for those who...
For those that are here, $25.
$25 cash or check paid to the order of?
Ellen Rodman or myself.
One of the authors. So thank you very much for coming. And those who would like a copy of the book, please come and do that.